So, tomorrow. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. May not have been what Shakespeare meant when he said that, but all our days on retreat can seem like a blur, just one day after another, after another. And after 2 weeks, or a month, or longer, tomorrow, things will change. And in this change, we go from intensive metta training here, in the safe confines of this place, this meditation center, and your metta retreat will be continued tomorrow, many of you, in the outside world. Sayadaw always says to people when they leave, please take your metta with you when you go out the gate. So to take what you've learned here, what you've understood here, in these refined and relatively simple conditions, and to apply them to the greater reality of your lives and in the larger world. The metaphor that came to me yesterday as I was reflecting about this, it's like taking a bunch of medical students from the classroom into their first practicum in the hospital. It's like, okay, guys, out you go. Guys, girls, all of you. So out we go into this outer world. And most of you here have a lot of practice experience. You've sat a lot of retreats. So I'm not going to spend much time today to belabor the nuts and bolts of what to do, how to take care of yourself through this time of change, or much about how to practice out there. You know that actually quite well. All I'll say about that latter bit is just do it. You, of course, can continue your practice in the formal sitting and all day long. There's so many opportunities, no matter how busy you are, no matter how fast-paced your life is, no matter how full it is with connections and responsibilities and multitasking and all of that. There are many, 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 many opportunities to practice loving kindness. If you were to practice loving kindness in your lives for 60 seconds, 60 times a day, that's an hour. So finding those seconds in your life, where not much is happening, where you might normally distract yourself with your device, you know, checking your Twitter account or whatever it is. Maybe you're walking down the street and there's a red light. Practice metta instead of clicking away on your telephone. Or maybe you're commuting and you're driving and you're stopped at a red light. And people are walking in front of the car. It's perfect time. Well, happy, peaceful. Well, happy, peaceful as people walk back and forth in front of the car. And then the light turns green and you go on your way. It There are many, many ways we can bring this practice alive in our lives. So all I want to say about that is to please get creative. Play with it. It's actually quite fun. It's like, where can I practice metta today that I haven't thought of yet? And there's so many possibilities. Really, though, rather than talking about that today, I want to talk about the bigger picture, about how we can take metta and make it a way to live. A way to live that actively resists societal currents that face and feed escalating hatred. As a way to live, to stand still and solid, not going with that stream of greed, hatred, delusion. Not adding to the suffering in the world. And really here I want to include compassion as well as metta. Compassion, of course, as you know, being that aspect of metta that turns towards suffering. Because in this world we're faced with so much suffering. We live in a world, let's face it, it's beset by conflict. It has always been so in the last 2,000 years, at least, if not longer. And now, of course, it seems more to be that way. There's conflict within countries, between countries, amongst members of families, amongst members, different members of communities that might have different religions, races, sexual orientations. And often conflict, of course, within ourselves. And all over the world right now, it's a time of change, a time seemingly of escalating tension. A time when fear is never very far away. Many places, fortunately not here in Burma, but many places, experience so much just what seems like random violence. It's become commonplace, not so shocking or surprising anymore. Its presence seems to be becoming the new, kind of the new normal. This new normal, which is really an unfolding of horror in the midst of communities that were once peaceful and relatively harmonious. And sad to say, public figures take these events, use them to cultivate fear, manipulate people with that fear for self-serving purposes. And as a result, there's just this kind of background hum of hatred that's now burst out into the public space. It seems to be okay to say all sorts of things on Twitter that normally we would never have articulated to each other. Over nothing, really, different views of the world. It's actually pretty scary. to be honest. At least I feel that sometimes. It's like, wow, what's happening here? And I know I'm not alone, because when you read the news, the words you read to describe the situation facing large parts of the world are things like unprecedented, extreme, chaotic. So I know I'm not alone in watching the heart and mind go to all sorts of interesting spaces about all of this. Going to those places where the thought just arises, something like, everything would be so much better if fill in the blank weren't on the planet. And fill in any name you like. But the troubles that plague the world now, extreme and different though they seem, are not going to go away with any imagined demise of any public figures or enemies. It's our sad human predicament that there seems to be, and has always been, an endless supply of bad guys. Sometimes the good guys win, sometimes the bad guys win. And it's our human predicament to be prone to all sorts of things. Really killing each other over territory, power, religion, or nothing at all. So if it's not one thing or one person, it's going to be another. So we just have to get over it. And I don't mean that in a harsh way. We have to learn to rest with this and find a place of safety inside. A wholesome place of safety. A lot of what's going on in the world is that people are making places of safety inside that are not wholesome. They're making enemies. They have kind of an internal map that says good, bad, like, don't like. Using people and situations as scapegoats. Blaming them for things we can't control, or maybe our own mistakes. I don't mean that kind of place of safety. Because, of course, we understand that the enemy is a construction of mind. And because we, having done this metta practice, because we understand that, of course we want to do whatever we can to stem this tide of hatred. To live and act in ways that reduce the heat and reduce the ill will and the suffering in the world. And we can be particularly sensitive to this as we leave a retreat where we've been cultivating loving kindness. We've been bathing in it here. This place is so safe and so soft and so wholesome. And the contrast can seem quite extreme when we go out there. And I would urge you to use that contrast not as a place to land with any dosa at all, oh, how horrible it is, or how terrible it is, or how shaky I feel. Use it as an inspiration. To cultivate hatred's opposite and to make that our heart's home. And to use that as the basis of radical action. His Holiness the Dalai Lama puts it this way: compassion is the radicalization of our time. I love that. This is radical action, cultivating compassion. At an individual level, every single one of you has seen in your own experience how you can stop hatred in its tracks. And how the metta can cut through that. And within ourselves, once we know how to access that metta heart, the choice is completely ours. We can add to the burden of hatred and fear in the world, or we can reduce it. It's up to us to decide how we deal with the internal and external complexities of our worlds. So which will we ultimately choose? Will we build those walls that hatred asks us to build? Or will we use metta to wear them down? The wonderful thing about metta, and actually I want to back up because that question is hypothetical. I know what you will all do. Everybody in this room is committed to kindness, or you wouldn't have been here in the first place. And now that you've been practicing, even more so. The wonderful thing about using the cultivation of loving kindness and compassion as radical action is that when we do this under difficult circumstances, other people are going to notice. Hatred may feed hatred, but of course, as you know, the opposite happens too. Metta also feeds more metta. It's like a virus. It's contagious. And we don't have to walk around teaching metta or preaching to all our friends and colleagues and family members. That would actually be fairly useless. I don't know about your family. I know about mine. They turn off completely. But if we can be metta rather than talking about it, people notice. They can't help it. So we can be the emissaries, really, the role models, prompting skillful action where it might not otherwise naturally arise. And in the Abhidhamma, when one talks about different mental factors, there are two categories for each given mental factors. They can arise unprompted, spontaneously, or they can arise with what's called promptitude. Meaning, we see somebody else do it and we think, oh, that's a good idea. And we do it too. And it's no less important, it's no less wholesome, because it had to be prompted. You don't have to go around criticizing yourself if this happens to you and you see somebody doing something wholesome and, oh, why didn't I think of that? Nah. Wholesome action, when we engage in it, it prompts others to do the same thing. And when others engage in it, maybe it prompts us to do the same thing. And you can imagine this feedback loop. As you know, the Buddha lived with a heart that had no barriers, no boundaries, no walls, with a boundless capacity to meet others exactly where they were. Not where he wanted them to be, but exactly where they were in that moment. Regardless. And in modeling that, of course, he had this huge and profound impact on the world. 2,500 years later, we're still talking about him. We're still doing the practices that he taught. And everyone can here can do a similar thing on an admittedly much smaller scale. Well, who knows, maybe somebody here. But, you know, even if we just touch one person, that's good enough. We never know where the consequences of that will go. And because in this time of global challenge, it's imperative we do something to stem this tide of hatred. Metta is hugely positive, useful, skillful, important. So as not to live our lives complicating already complicated situations. And whatever we do has to start here. Right here in the heart, and widens out from there. So that's what we've been doing in these last weeks, this month. Cultivating the heart. Cultivating the habit and the skill of loving kindness. This is metta in thought, as Ariya said yesterday. And in the greater scope of our lives, of course, as she also said, there's metta in speech and metta in deed, metta in action. And she closed her talk yesterday with an explanation of the importance of sila as a metta practice. And today I want to share some further reflections about metta in speech and metta in action. Starting with speech, because very soon you will be starting with speech. And speech has particular power. It's just words. And I don't have to say anything more, really. We all know the power of words. The power of good, the power of harm. And the basic guidelines for right speech, for skillful speech, that the Buddha offered were very simple. Wholesome speech needs to fulfill four aspects. It needs to be true. It needs to be useful. It needs to be spoken at the right time. And it needs to be spoken with a heart of loving kindness. So if there's something that we feel we need to say, somebody said it's hard to improve on silence, but if we need to say anything, is it true? Is it useful? Can it be received by the person we're speaking to? And is it spoken with a heart of loving kindness? It can be true. It can be useful. It can be receivable on the other end. If we're angry when we say it, the Buddha says, no, don't say it. Or it can be true. It can be useful. It can be said with a heart of loving kindness. But if for some reason the other person can't take it in, the Buddha says, don't waste your breath. Don't say it. And likewise with any of those others. And of course, we can't live by constantly say, okay, I'm going to say something now. Is it true? Is it useful? We can't go through that list quickly. It needs to be a default setting. Speaking what's true, speaking what's useful at the right time and with a heart of metta. So it's a practice, just like the metta itself. It's a form of metta practice. And when this practice reaches its culmination in somebody who has a lot of skill with speech, the chant that we've been doing is completely right on. It is. The words of these people are sweet, beneficial, pleasing to hear. Even if the message might be difficult, but this is one area in our everyday life practice that is particularly difficult. It can be really, really challenging in this regard to speak the truth, to speak what's useful, to know whether our words can be received, and above all, to be speaking with a heart of loving kindness in situations where there's conflict, or when people are harming us, or they're just being difficult. And everyone occasionally has conflicts with other people. We're not all the same, so ideas vary about how things need to be done or what's right and what's wrong. So we all have these difficulties, these challenges in our relationships with family members, with friends, with colleagues, with neighbors. Neighbors can be a really good one. These are an unavoidable part of being human. And unfortunately, our society tends to reinforce habits of anger and retaliation rather than habits of metta with regard to speech. And our society can actually encourage us to escalate situations rather than to skillfully work with them. So how do we speak when we're provoked? How do we speak when we have a difficult message to deliver to somebody that we think, oh boy, this is going to be hard for them to hear, but I know they can take it in? How do we speak when somebody attacks us? The Buddha had a high bar when he was talking to monks. He said, "Monks, some might speak to you using speech that is timely or untimely, gently, gentle or harsh, with good intent or with harmful intent, with a heart of metta or with hostility." In other words, you're going to get speech for coming at you that's skillful or not. His instructions to the monks was this: our minds will not be affected by this, nor will we give in to hatred and react with harsh words. Instead, we shall abide with a mind of loving kindness for that person, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. You know those words very well. This is another place where these lines show up. And the Buddha says, it is in this way, monks, that you should train yourselves. And I really appreciate that last line, because it's not the Buddha saying, you have to do this. And if you can't do it, you're not a good monk. He's saying, train yourselves to do this. It's a very different instruction. Training means, oh boy, occasionally we won't manage. We'll fall on our face. We'll make a mistake. But we keep inclining in that direction. And how we speak when people attack us can make such a difference in terms of simple community harmony. And I'm not saying we need to roll over and play dead and let them have their way if it's unwholesome. But we can stand up for ourselves without creating more conflict. A long time ago now, I had a wonderful example of this. My then husband and I had moved into a house in a community in New Zealand, and we had a fabulous view of this lake with mountains on the other side. And our property was quite steep, and there was somebody who lived, our neighbor behind us, was quite a ways above us. And on the boundary between our properties was this immense hedge, which the previous owners of our house had planted. And they warned us when we moved in, you're going to have a lot of trouble with the guys on the back. You know, those neighbors are really bad neighbors, and they're always complaining, and they took us to court, and we've had no end of conflict with them. So be careful. So we bought the house, we moved in. And sure enough, we hadn't been there very long, and I was up on the back part of the section, gardening, and the neighbor pops around, and he says, oh, hello, he introduced himself, I'm your neighbor from the back, and by the way, and then his voice got really hard, and he says, I could tell there was a lot of energy there, he says, you have to trim the hedge. And I thought, oh, I see. But having been prepared for this assault, and it really was, it came with a lot of energy, I just quietly kind of smiled and said, you know, we understand you do have your right to your view as well. And then it turned into a conversation about how beautiful the view was and how much I appreciated the view and understanding, yeah, we understand you want your view too, so don't worry, we'll keep the hedge trimmed. There was no going to court. There was no battle of wills. There was no attachment on our part that we should be able to grow the hedge as high as we wanted. It was already really high anyway. And trimming it low meant trimming it at about 15 feet rather than 20 or 30. It wasn't a hedge. It was basically trees that they just kept topped. So it was easy. There was no conflict. And then it turned into this decade-long back and forth over that hedge. Hey, do you want some lemons? I got a ton of lemons. Hey, we have some silver beet. Do you want some? No one went to court over that. But if I had responded in that first moment of, what do you mean? This is my hedge, you know. Don't tell me what to do. You know where that would have gone. And it's a really simple, everyday example. But how often do we get caught in these kinds of dynamics? And that's, again, where we get caught in my hedge. Who's he telling me what? So this can make a huge difference. Just a few words can change a whole dynamic of a relationship. If the other person feels heard, if they feel respected, we don't have to agree, but can we hear each other? Can we articulate that respect and that openness? Of course, this isn't always easy. And we're not always successful, as I was saying. That's why it's a training. And with this form of the metta practice, we're definitely working against the current of worldly convention and against the stream of ego. The metta practice of speaking kindly is actually revolutionary. We're stopping in the middle of the predominant flow of culture and ego and saying, "Oop, wait a minute, I'm not going there. I will not choose to speak from anger. I want to speak and cultivate speech that comes from metta." And that stopping can just be a pause, an internal pause. It's like, whoa, not going there. And this not going there really comes from a place of understanding the dangers of dosa that Ariya has talked about, that Saito's talked about. And when we understand the suffering that comes from that, it's easier to pause. It's easier to stop. And with this kind of speech, anger does not ever escalate because it robs it of its fuel. And with regard to the practice of speaking kindly, I'm no expert. I'm actually more of an expert in its opposite. And being an expert in its opposite, I know the pain it causes. So speech that points a finger that blames or accuses, pointing a finger outside or inside, speech that doesn't take responsibility for our part in a situation, a challenge, speech that belittles other people, that makes them a problem. This is the suffering that we need to understand and really connect with if we're to succeed in this practice of right speech. Being able to say things in a skillful way when there's conflict or difficulty, is really something, as I said, that can make a huge difference in our lives and in our communities. One cool head in the room can make a huge difference. I remember quite a long time ago now, I was the staff board member of the Insight Meditation Society. And we were having quite a heated discussion in a board meeting about something that people felt very strongly about. And this was a room full of about 30 people, all of whom had a lot of Dharma experience. But the discussion was getting quite intense. And in the middle of that discussion, all it took was one person who raised her hand kind of tentatively, but then she said, "You know, I don't even know why we're talking about this way." And she said that in a very cool way. And it took the heat out of the room instantly. It was quite an amazing thing to see and be part of, because I had really been on one side or the other of that discussion. I'd been totally involved in it. So everybody else can be losing their head in the room. If you are the one person with the cool head, you can change everything. And while it's not always possible to be nice, quote unquote, all the time, because, as I said, sometimes we have to say difficult things. While it's not always possible to be nice all the time, we can speak from metta. And while it's hard to do, this kind of speech, not only does it cultivate harmony, it's actually much more likely to be heard than that other kind of speech, much more likely to be received, much more likely to have the result we desire. And it's all about understanding in ourselves about intention and attitude. What's impelling our speech? Why do we want to say what we want to say? That's basically the essence of this practice. If we can understand what our intention is, we're much more likely to be able to fulfill these aspects of right speech, these four aspects, because we'll know whether it's wholesome or unwholesome. So exploring why we want to say what we want to say can be very, very interesting and very useful. Perhaps it's fear or needing control. Perhaps it's insecurity, envy, jealousy, greed, defensiveness. Any of these unwholesome mind states can be there in the background, kind of being the flame under whatever speech might come out. So exploring these things gently but persistently can be very, very useful. And seeing these states as they are with metta for ourselves, as you've seen in the last month or 2 weeks, is simply the metta practice. Acknowledging them, keeping going with the metta. We have to accept the presence of our demons with a certain amount of gracefulness and graciousness, just as that story that Ariya told about Sakka, king of the gods, and the anger-eating demon. It wasn't, "Get off my throne, you ugly thing." It was, "Oh, welcome, friend. Would you like some tea?" And of course, we don't invite the anger-eating demon to stay forever. But if we don't resist the anger, if we don't feed the anger, if we just acknowledge it, let it be there, and incline the heart to loving kindness instead, the anger-eating demon, well, you know the story, poof, gone. And in everyday life, just as in formal meditation practice, speech is where we can actively use our own experience as a bridge to how another might feel receiving this speech. So understanding what's impelling the speech, understanding our motivation is one aspect. And then also connecting with the other person with that metta that understands, oh, okay, I need to say this. How can I say this? How would I like to hear these words? Or how would I not like to hear these words? So if we have the presence of mind to remember how it feels to receive words spoken from unwholesome places versus how it feels to receive words spoken from wholesome places, that's another place where that pause can be very, very useful in making sure we speak from that place of metta. Working at this level is very deep metta practice. It might be day by day by day, moment by moment. And not as quiet as here, of course. But in this fast-paced world, where we're increasingly communicating instantaneously, and there's that pressure to do so more and more and more and quicker and quicker. When conflict arises, metta speech is both harder and much more important. So it's also very, very easy in the midst of a situation like this. Say we get an SMS. It's like, oh, this text lights up our phone and we just go, phew, or whatever, however we might respond to that out of anger. It's easy to forget metta speech and send out a quick tweet or a biting email or a nasty SMS in return. There's a certain person on the global stage right now showing us all the dangers of doing this. It's not useful. Because I know I've had this experience, and I'm sure all of you maybe have had too. Have you ever written something, like an email or something, and hit the send button and then immediately regretted it? Oh. But it's gone. Nothing you can do about it. Can't get it back. This is, you know, just like speech that comes out of our mouths. But the wonderful thing about the kind of speech that we engage in electronically is that we are usually on our own. We're not faced with the person. And we have a moment to say, do I really want to send this? And if we're really angry, we can write that email and leave it till the morning. And I find this sometimes quite amusing because I've done this many times. You know, just really kind of hot under the collar about something and wanting to share that story with some third party and how bad it is and If I had the presence of mind to leave that until tomorrow morning and look at it again, sometimes I laugh out loud. It's like, oh, forget that. Erase. So electronic speech gives us the chance to edit, to reflect, to pause, to practice loving kindness, and to come back to it, even if it's just a minute or two. That's much more of a pause than we ever get when we're speaking with somebody one-on-one. And in the midst of all the interpersonal challenges in the world right now, a single kind word can make such a big difference. Kind words do bring peaceful results, as Chemie Saito said in that chant. And I often think in this regard about my own father, who he was from New York, a bit hot-headed, meaning he was quick to anger and quick to articulate it. He was very articulate. He was a physician and a really good man. He was a wonderful doctor. But if somebody got him mad, usually a hospital administrator or you name it, boom. Especially when he was younger. He got fired from jobs as a result. He got sent to Okinawa during World War II because he told his commanding officer that he thought he had for brains. You know, he learned from hard experience the dangers of anger when it's articulated in speech. And when he was older and wiser, if you asked him what he wanted for his birthday or Christmas, all he would say, and he meant this, was peace, quiet, and a few kind words. And I really appreciate that, you know, because a few kind words are more invaluable than anything. Just as a few unkind words can injure, can cause a lot of harm, a few kind words are like gold. So action. I wanted to talk much more about speech than about action. But just to say from thought springs action. And we live in this world and have to do many worldly things. We have family responsibilities. We have responsibilities to our employer. We have friends. We may be engaged in many things besides those things. And compassionate action, metta action, is a skill and an art. It, like speech, is practice. And whatever we undertake needs to be solidly grounded in two things. Whatever actions we do. The first is an attitude of patience. Ajahn Punyadamo, who is a wonderful Canadian monk in the Thai forest tradition with a very dry wit, one time told somebody who was complaining to him about her situation. He said, with a big smile on his face, he said, "Samsara is not supposed to work." That was his response to that long story he was being told. In other words, yes, and? People are who they are. Things are what they are. We can't change a lot of that. And there are harmful things happening all over the world. But we need to understand that the people that are doing this, and not only is samsara not supposed to work, but the people that are doing this are not those actions. It's very easy to fall into that place of pointing the finger and saying how bad they are because they believe X, Y, or Z. One line I love from the Buddha is, "The world argues with me, I do not argue with the world." So instead of arguing with the way things are, this kind of patience that needs to be at the ground of all our action understands, really, it's a place of wise view that understands things are the way they are, we cannot control them, and people act as they do because of karma, because of conditions. It's not personal. And metta is without condition. We don't radiate metta to people so that anything, so that they will get over this idea they have and stop harming people, so that they will change with regards to us or whatever. It's just, may you be happy. And this gives us a stable place to stand, a stable place to act from. The unconditionality of metta also means we have the flexibility and the fearlessness that comes from a freedom of being partial. So with metta, we can respond to people as they are now, not how we would like them to be, not how we think they are from a past story. His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, "The more you are motivated by love, the more fearless and free your actions will be." So this kind of patience that metta gives us is a really powerful ally in our lives. And then, of course, there's the aspect of action that knows, just as with speech, knows and discerns when action is skillful, when it's useful, when it's practical, and when it isn't any of those things. That knows what's our business and what's somebody else's business. There's an expression somebody shared with me quite some time ago that was like, there are three kinds of business: my business, your business, and God's business. And the only business I need to attend to is my business. I like that because it's basically an articulation of boundaries. So we have the discernment about usefulness and about boundaries. Not poking our nose into somebody else's business. Not launching into something that's useless, where we can't make a difference. And given the scope of our lives and the scope of the world's problems, really, it's easy to go to discouragement. It's easy to say, oh, well, my business is such a small thing. But when we act and speak from this kind of discernment that metta offers us, we don't know what the results of that speech and that kind action will be. If you drop a stone in the pond, the ripples go out. You don't know what they're going to touch. I keep quoting His Holiness today. He's reflected a lot about speech and action. And I like this quote. If you think you're too small to make a difference, try sleeping with a mosquito. So metta speech, metta action, even if it's only from this one place, from our hearts, can make a huge difference in the world. We don't know. All any of us has to do is to take this practice into our lives and to do the best we can with it. Using this retreat as the foundation for further practice in metta speech and metta action. So I wanted to close today with a final quote from His Holiness. I could have just strung all these together. And this one I very much appreciate, though. More probably than all the rest. He said, "No matter what is going on, never give up. Develop the heart. Too much energy in your country is spent developing the mind instead of the heart. Be compassionate, not just to your friends, but to everyone. Work for peace in your heart and peace in the world. Work for peace. And I say again, never give up. No matter what is going on around you, never give up." So may we never give up this practice of developing the heart, of metta in speech, metta in action, metta in thought. And may we all, by doing this practice, benefit the world and all the beings in it. Thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.